Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And happy Thanksgiving to everyone celebrating. A big thank you to all of you for listening to and hanging with me here on Talk is Jericho. You know, I love doing this show, and I wouldn't be able to do it without all of you sexy beast Talk is Jericho listeners. So cheers and happy Thanksgiving to all of you. All right, got a good one for you today. Dustin Rhodes returns to Talk is Jericho, this time as a solo act. He came face to face with the Chupacabra and lived to tell the tale. He'll share the details coming up here. That's how we're going to start this show today. But he's also about to celebrate his 35th anniversary in the wrestling business, so we decided to break down some of his favorite all-time matches. We hit the 10-man tag he had with the Hart Foundation, Brett Owen, the Anvil, Jim Neidhart, Davey Boy Smith, and Brian Pillman versus Dustin, Ken Shamrock, Steve Austin, and the Road Warriors. That was in Calgary. We got the Gold Dust versus Savio Vega match at Madison Square Garden that really launched the popularity of the Gold Dust character. The unbelievable backyard brawl he had with Roddy Piper at WrestleMania 12. The crazy vignette pre-shoot they did in LA, kind of one of the precursors to the cinematic matches that we saw during the pandemic. This cinematic match that ended up with both guys being sent to the hospital. We got the 1992 War Games match between Sting Squadron and the Dangerous Alliance. And, of course, his huge match with his brother Cody at AEW's first Double or Nothing pay-per-view. And then, of course, we talk about what it's like for Dustin State at AEW now that Cody has returned to WWE. Great stuff coming up with the legendary Dustin Rhodes. And if you haven't booked your cabin yet for Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea, Four Leaf Clover, you still got time. There are cabins left at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. We set sail February 2nd. For the first time ever, we're going to our own private island at Great Stirrup Cay. And it's going to be amazing. Come hang with me. It's a pretty stacked lineup of talent. We just announced a whole gaggle of AEW talent over the last few days, including the acclaimed Nyla Rose, Vicky Guerrero, as well as Phoenix, the Lucha Brothers, Phoenix and Penta, Cero Miedo. We got Ricky Starks, Top Flight, Darius joining his brother Dante Martin, Christopher Daniels, Chaos Project, Aubrey Edwards, Swerve Strickland. So many huge, huge stars coming to join us. Jade Cargill, of course. You can go find the entire lineup at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. We're also going to figure out who the first ever Jericho Cruise Oceanic champion is. ChrisJerichoCruise.com, still cabins available. All right, and speaking of music and Fozzy, we are headed to Australia next week. We are super stoked and excited for that. We haven't been to Australia since 2018. It's going to be a huge whirlwind tour. Four gigs in 5 days, starting November 30th in Brisbane, December 2nd in Melbourne, December 3rd in Sydney, and December 4th in Adelaide. So go get ready for that. It's going to be a rock and roll party for sure. Come and join us as we tear down the house in Australia. And of course, we're hitting the States again in March. Lots of great stuff coming up, but most importantly, right here, right now, it's the return of Dustin Rhodes on Talk is Jericho. Right here on the night before Thanksgiving. A few months ago, I was reading Twitter and I saw Dustin Rhodes was talking about Chupacabras. And you had mentioned a few things, we'll discuss that. And I was like, oh, we need to talk about Chupacabras with Dustin because you've seen some, had encounters with some. And just to first explain, the Chupacabra, which means, I think it means like a sucker, like a blood sucker, goat sucker.
Goat sucker.
Goat I sucker, think. Right?
Yeah, it's a Mexican blood sucker in Mexico.
Okay. So, and you live in Texas. And
yeah.
There's lots of sightings of these Chupacabras in Texas. So what do you know about it? Go ahead.
So on Thanksgiving, we always get together as a family. We have a little trailer and side-by-side, and we set little fires because we live out and we own, my sister owns the whole cove basically, and we can drive around at little stops. So we made little fires for each little stop, and we have like some s'mores and all that, you know, and we try to scare them, all that kind of stuff. So we went out and made the fires, and the golf carts are coming. We can hear them, so we're waiting. I'm jumping in a tree because we like to scare the kids as they come by, you know, because there's a whole trailer load of kids. So they come to the first spot, they come to the second, and I'm sitting over there and we're lighting a fire towards the end of the track there around the cove. And there's a little cave that goes down, a little alcove when you follow it down towards the lake. And we do a lot of hunting there. And it's perfect the way we've set it up and everything. So I'm sitting there and I'm waiting. I'm listening to them. They're probably a half a mile away because it's a pretty big cove. And I hear this noise over in the trees. And I'm like, what the hell is that, man? And I know deer sounds. I know bear sounds. I know all the, you know, basic sound, coyotes, all that. And all of a sudden, I seen it kind of run by and dart it. So I shine the spotlight over there on it. And it saw me. I was like, I think that's a chupacabra. So I went after it, right? And it's pretty, they get pretty big. They get about 5 foot when they're standing on their hind feet. And I followed it, and I was watching it run down, and they kind of look like a cross of a real rabid coyote, but bigger. And their two front bottom teeth come up kind of like a vampire, right? They don't have the two top ones, but the two bottom fangs stick way up. That's what kind of puts out the chupacabras. So I get down to the cave and I cornered him, and that's the wrong thing to do. And I found that out the first time. If you watch Jurassic Park in that first movie where the guy wrecks his Jeep and that thing that fans out,
yeah.
Right? It made that same kind of noise and it hissed at me. It scared the shit out of me. It scared the shit out of me. And I just kind of backed out of there, man. He stood on his two hind legs and just made this evil noise that was just horrifying. So I ran back up and I was telling everybody about it. And they're like, you didn't see no chupacabra. Yeah, I did.
So what color was it?
It was like a gray and black, not striped, but, you know, just real mangy looking. They look really mangy and like rabid.
Because sometimes they say that it could just be a coyote with mange, right? Like, which a mange, it's like some kind of a parasite that basically eats the fur.
Their fur and their skin and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but it wasn't that a coyote with mange?
Was not a coyote, man. And it stood on its back hind legs, like that's Bigfoot or something. And I'm just like, you got to be kidding me. And I had it cornered, and that's the wrong thing to do. And I did not have any firearms on me or anything. And it's, you know, we're here for the kids. We're lighting fires, having s'mores and doing all that. But I wanted to see it up close. And I got a really up close view of it, and it scared me.
So when it went on its hind legs, you just took off running?
I just kind of backed out of there, you know? It's like a rattlesnake. You just kind of walk away from it and get away from it before it strikes you. And they can only do half the size of their body. If it's a six-foot snake, they can only strike 3 foot.
Hmm.
So you just kind of back out of there. That's what I did, and I went back up the hill. But once I started getting up the hill, I kind of ran back, and I was like, Jesus. And my heart was pounding. It was crazy.
So have you told anybody that story before? Like
a couple people, like, you know, the neighbors and stuff like that, and they see them all the time, they say. So it's that's the first time, my first encounter with an actual chupacabra, though.
That's unbelievable, because like you said, most people go, oh, come on, it wasn't. But you're talking to me as straight as you can. And the reason that you believe it is because it jumped up on its hind legs.
Yes, that's the only reason. And it hissed at me, and I saw the two front fangs, and I've seen pictures of them now. And people have caught pictures of them. Some of them are phony and fake, but I've seen the real one, and it looks a lot like them. And they have a place in Odessa, Texas, I think at one of the agricultural centers there or whatever, of a stuffed one. And it's like, that can't be real, but it is.
What do you think it is?
I don't know. a dog, coyote, mix, something, but with these big fangs.
You know, it's interesting because this happens from time to time where they'll find new species, and even there's a form of a rhino that they have found before that they didn't think existed. There's coelacanths, which are prehistoric fish. They thought it had been gone for millions of years. They caught one just 50 years ago. So who's to say it's not some sort of, you know, untapped species that we had no idea about?
It could be a reptilian that came up from the earth. It's crust, you know? I mean, you got aliens and reptilians that have been here forever, so they say.
You got to go put your paint on and go back out there and scare the shit back out of it.
I don't know about that, man. That thing scared me to death.
Wow. And that was the only, did you say you had two?
Just the one, really, that gotcha. Was up close like that.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Documented sighting of a chupacabra, and a great way to start a show. We've been meaning to talk for a while about this.
Yeah.
And we were going to talk also about some of your favorite matches, because the reason why this spurred my job and memory is that we talked a few weeks ago about how you're coming up on your 35th year in the business. And besides you and Sting, I have the most experience here, but you have more. You're one of the few that's been in the business longer than I have.
We're all there together.
All there together, but a couple of years before. So I was just thinking, like, 35 years, and you've had such a career resurgence over the last few years since you came to AEW. And, you know, people always ask me, like, what's your favorite match? And I always have, like, a bunch in my head, but I always kind of enjoy talking about them. And I thought maybe we could do the same with you.
Sure.
And another thing that I was, I mean, we can just kick it right off, because I just read a book. It's a great book about Davey Boy and Dynamite, the British Bulldogs.
Yeah.
And the whole story of their lives and their separate lives together, and talked about the Hart Foundation, the five of them, when it was Brett, Anvil, Owen.
Yeah. Dynamite and...
Davey and Pillman.
Pillman, yeah.
And they had one of the greatest matches and one of the greatest shows, Canadian Stampede. Now, everyone remembers that show and that match, but they forget a lot of times who the opponents were. And one of those opponents was you.
Yes, yes.
Shamrock, Dustin.
Austin.
Austin and the Road Warriors. Legion of Doom.
Yeah, yeah.
So kind of tell me about that match, because I watched it back and the crowd was just so crazy and just the whole
world of it. Like, you've been in many arenas, right? And you've heard all kinds of reactions. This has to rank up there with one of the loudest moments I've ever been or witnessed inside the ring. And of course, they're the heels and we're the baby faces. And it switched immediately. It's like, no, they love the Hart Foundation. They love the Harts here in this corner. And it was like, okay, well, we're going to be selling our asses off. Here we go. And we all did our little piece of business, but the whole match, it was just, it's the loudest. It has to be. Like, from when I used to watch Dad and or the Rock and Roll and Midnight Express in the Charlotte Coliseum, the old Charlotte Coliseum, that was like some of the loudest matches I've ever heard, because every girl was screaming for the Rock and Roll Express, right? It was like that, man. That Saddle Dome, what is it called?
Saddle Dome,
right?
Yeah.
Loud, the acoustics in there were just perfect, and it was sold out, man, just crazy. They built up for that match. It was such a wonderful part to be in a piece of that, you know.
Well, because I think that's when Brett and the guys were doing, they were heels unless they were in Canada.
Unless they were in Canada.
They'd be baby faces, right?
Absolutely. But we had no idea the reactions were going to be that big. It was like, no, you are not the baby faces. These guys are the baby faces. And like, okay, well, shit, we got to switch it on the fly. And a lot of people don't know how to do that. Just kind of go with it.
How was that team put together? Because obviously the Hart Foundation, there's five. Do you remember? Like, I know a lot of that might be a little bit shady memories from that time frame for you too, but it was such kind of a ragtag collection of guys. Was there an angle for it, or that's you the guys?
Honest with you, I'd have to really look at it and go back, because I can't remember a lot of things that happened. But I do remember that match, and I just don't remember what led us up to that.
Do you remember putting the match together?
Kind of. You know, it's a lot of, okay, I'll do this to you and you do this to me type stuff. We really didn't have much of a structure. We just went out and had fun. It's like the old days when you just go out there and have fun and call stuff. And today, they don't do that, you know, unless you're you.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if you and I were working, we would just know the finish and, you know, it's it.
That's one thing I like.
We just go out and react.
That's something I like working with Eddie Kingston. Is we called a couple things back here, but did a lot of it out there.
And that's where the magic happens.
That's freedom, right? Yeah.
Yes. You go out there in different towns, different arenas, right? And you have a set match that you're usually doing or whatever. It might not work in New York City as opposed to Philadelphia. And it's like, you got to switch it up. You got to be able to switch it up on the fly like that and make things work. Because crowds are different. Deep South is a little different than the North.
Yeah, I remember too, it was such a great spot there where I think at the end of the match, Steve gets into like a little bit of a pushing match with Stu, and then he gets arrested.
Yeah, I remember that. He was sitting on the front row.
He put his hands behind his back.
I think Bruce was there too, right?
All of them were there. You remember at the end, Hart got in the ring?
Yes.
How crazy it was?
It was nuts.
Yeah, I remember that Steve was given the finger with the handcuffs behind his back at that point in time, you know?
It's good shit.
What was it like working with, like, for example, with Brett, and what was it like working with Owen? Did you work with them quite a bit?
I worked with Owen a few times. I worked with Brett a few times. Brett, so easy, you know. I mean, just really basic and very easy, but just we had moments, right? And we knew when to take those moments and let things breathe instead of going to the next thing. And it was pretty simple stuff. But I swear to God, man, that stuff still works today if you utilize it. And it's a lot of basic stuff, and there's not a lot of dives and things like that, right? We just heat, come back, shine, you know, stuff like that, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And Brett was one of those that can make things work like that. Same with Owen. But Owen was more of the jokester, you know, and you're in a live event and you've been on the road for 10 days and we're just having fun and he's just, you know, trying to rib me in the ring or something, you know, and trying to break me or crack me a little bit and you're having fun. He was one of those that just always, everybody loved him. He was the jokester and you always got along with Owen, man. It was just, he was such a good kid to be around. Mm-hmm. Right, all of them were. Brett too, man. I love being around Brett, one of the best.
It's crazy too when you think about that. Out of those 10 guys, I think there's only four of you guys that are still with us, because both Road Warriors are gone and all four of the Heart Foundation. Brett's the last one. When you see that,
I think right now, like you, me, Brett, you could say, you know, staying, we're the kind of the last of our kind. Mm-hmm. Right, and you have all these new kids, and do they listen? Sometimes, you know, but it's like, if you're a big fan of pro wrestling, you're always studying, you're always watching the past, because hey man, without the new, you know, without the old school, there is no new school, right? Mm-hmm. So you just, that's how you grow, right? It's progress, and you take a couple things that you've never tried before, like for me personally, and then that sticks out in their mind. Well, Dustin did a Canadian Destroyer. Why would he do that? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just did it, but that kept me alive for another month or two. And it's like, wow, man, he's 50 and he's doing this. It's whatever I can hold on to like grow my personal brand, mm-hmm, and make it better and stay in the best shape that I can. But that's it. Smart and do things thing. Smartly.
But it's smart to do that. You talk about the Canadian Destroyer. And I remember when you first started doing it, why wouldn't you do it? Because it's like, why would you just want to do the same moves always? But when you do something you like that, like you said, it stands out and it's like, oh my gosh, he's still, it's like Sting jumping off the freaking tunnel. Yeah, it's like, why does he do, he don't have to do that. No, he does have to do that. And you have to do that and I have to do it, because that's how we are as performers and as athletes and as professionals. We have to keep pushing the boundaries, right?
Have to. Yeah. If you get complacent, you're going to be dead in the water. Mm-hmm. And it's happened a bunch to me. And I got to like go back to ground zero and say, look, what can I do to bring some life back into my character? Whatever. If it was gold dust, if it's dust in here, whatever it is, I need something. I need a spark. But you also, a person has to be willing to do it with you, you know, and it takes two, like it always does. Mm-hmm. Can't just go out there and have a match with myself. I could, but it would be terrible. You need two people to make this dance and the magic happen. And I think that, you know, my later years now at 53, if I slip up and they see it, you know, they're all over it. And they're the 10 loudest on social media, but they stick with me. And it's like, man, maybe I do need to retire. Mm. So it's really in the back of my head. I cannot go out there and mess up. And when I do, it's like, hopefully I mess up really professionally and they see it, or they don't catch it because I cover it so well. And it's like, well, I'm glad they didn't catch that one, because they would definitely be eating me up, you know?
I've had that. I've done Lion Salt. I don't know, probably here 100 times in my career, I don't know, 1,000 maybe. And a couple of years ago here in AW, when we were doing Jacksonville, I slipped and I barely made the rotation. But you would have thought, like, okay, Jericho needs to go. He needs to retire. He needs to quit. And it's like, it happens. You know, Wayne Gretzky misses the net sometimes when he takes a slap shot. But what you said, as you get older, then suddenly you're too old. If you have a great match, you're a physical wonder. Look at this guy, like Dustin Rhodes, he's better than he's ever been. But if you miss one thing, oh, he's too old, get him out of the game. It's hard, because I know you've had issues in the past with mental health and all the stuff we've been through. Does that bother you when you read that on social media? Does it stick in your head?
No, because, you know, I'm very open about it, and everybody knows my dark times that I went through and stuff, and I survived and came out the other end and then sticking to my guns, you know? So I've accepted it. Nobody really... It's more of an inspiration, because on social media, I try to be more inspirational now, because there's so much conflict and so much drama negativity and crap on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Unless I'm not posting about a match or something like that, it's only like inspirational stuff. And I think that has done me well, and it's probably helped a few people along the way. So,
I think so.
Hey, man, that's whatever. That's great. I'm glad.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of your other matches that you appreciate that stick out for you.
You and I have talked about the Cody match. So that's really up there as one of the...
Well, I don't know if we really have spoke about it on the record before. Let's talk about that, because that was still one of the best matches in our company's history. And it was early on, maybe the first pay-per-view or second pay-per-view, something like that?
First.
How was that working against your brother? And let's kind of go into that, because it was an all-time classic for sure.
So a lot of people know, because I've talked about it, about me pitching to Vince constantly, you know, like 6 years in a row that I wanted to work my brother on WrestleMania. And to be honest with you, you know, they just said it wasn't good enough to be on in that position. We had a match at Fastlane with Stardust versus Goldust, and it was terrible. It was awful. The finish came off a little awkward because his shoulder came up, and there was a three count, and it was bad. And it, you know, it wasn't in Cody's heart. It really wasn't in my heart, you know. So you kind of, you go through it, and then I leave, and I come here, and it's like this opportunity opens up to have this WrestleMania moment on Double or Nothing, our first pay-per-view, you know. Let's give it all we got. And it was a two promo bill that, I mean, I think the story was already there. It was already built up over the years because I expressed it that I wanted this match. And now it was, hey, we need to deliver it. And him coming out and me being from WWE and not knowing this crowd, if they're going to react to me in a good way, because it's more of an independent kind of crowd that have come together for this new revolution. And, they responded to him, and I knew he was over, right? And it was great. He's doing the best work in his career. And he hit the throne, man, and the whole thing towards Hunter and, you know, the big throne with the sledgehammer and all that stuff. And then my music hit, and they responded in kind. And I was like, because I was really nervous. I was 50. I hadn't worked in several months, and I was just like, man, I'm going to blow up. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And I walked down, and as soon as you leave, you know, like if you stand at the, and I still get nervous at the stairs, right? And as soon as you walk through the tunnel, man, it just kind of, it goes away. And everybody just kind of disappears. And I got in the ring, and we just stood there, and we stared at each other, right, with the announcements. And it had the big fight feel, to me, at least. And then I pointed up, you know, and it was a real emotional moment. And I could see it in Cody's eyes, and it was for me, definitely. And they started chanting Dad's name. So I knew he was there. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, you can see everybody in the audience, but you can't see them, right? And you can hear them, but you can't hear them. You're so laser focused on what the job is and what needs to be done. And we went through it. And we could have missed 1,000 things in that match or botched 1,000 things, and it wouldn't have mattered. It was just like the stars aligned for that match. And we just went through it, and there was more emotion, more investment in the audience, man, and they felt everything. And we took them on that ride, and we told a nice little story with it, and they were crying, grown men in there crying. I was crying, everybody was crying, man. It's like these hard-ass men in the audience are crying. That's what I want to do, right? I want to invoke that emotion from somebody. And I tell the kids in my class right now all the time, it's not about the move sets that you do out there or what you say to the audience. It's how you make them feel.
It's the story.
If you can make them feel something, they're not turning the channel. And that's what we want, right? They're going to come back for it. And they were there that night. The stars aligned, and it was damn near perfection. And it was a good feeling that, you know, I had that behind me. I lost so much blood that night, and I was really kind of messed up with that, with dizzy and everything. And I was getting dizzy in the match. I was giving a superplex off the top, and we almost teetered. I was like, we got to go now. So I went, and we made it. Otherwise, if I'd have waited another second, we would have ended up, like, on the ropes.
So you really felt it?
I felt it big time. I lost the most blood. I'd been out of practice, you know. It'd been a long time. You don't. We're not allowed to do that up there.
Right.
And it's like, all right, let's do this. But we made it work, and it is the funnest time I've ever been in a wrestling ring. I know Cody, he's got some other matches that he likes more than this one. But for me, that was tops. There's some great ones out there, you know, but that was the one that really stood tall. And you know, still stands.
You know what's great to me? Because like, remember, it was a two promo build, and I think it was based. What was it even based around? Who's the better Rhodes, or what was your basic?
Cody was like killing the Attitude Era. So he was killing the old, you know, and bringing out the new. Dustin or whatever, you know.
But like Pat always used to tell me, like even for this weekend with Bryan Danielson and I, it's like there's really not anything more we need to do. The match is made. You know, there's certain matches that the match is there. You don't have to do a heat angle or, you know, a couple promos, whatever the hell we've been doing, but everyone wants to see it. And it was the same with Cody versus Dustin. And the best part was after with Cody's speech where he said, I can't remember the exact words, but I don't need a opponent, or I need a brother. Or I need a, whatever. What was that? What did he say again?
He said,
I don't need a partner. I need a brother or something.
I need my brother, right? I need a partner. I need my brother for the big,
yeah.
The Young Bucks, for the Fight for the Fallen, for the second one.
Yeah.
And it was a throwback from what Dad said to me in the ring. One of Dad's greatest promos he had, not the Hard Times promo, but it was like, Arn had turned on me, and it was a throwback from that. I don't need another partner. I don't need this. I need my son. And it was an emotional moment. So he did the little throwback to that, and they felt it. And it was so good, man. So good. I'm glad that thing is over. I could never duplicate that ever again. You know, everybody's like saying, man, you guys need to have a second match. And it's like, no, I'm not touching that. I can't, because it won't live up to the expectations.
I don't know if you ever follow this or not, but it was given a five-star rating by Meltzer, which is very hard to get.
Yeah.
I think you were the oldest. It actually made me mad, because I was the oldest guy to have a five-star match with Kenny at the Tokyo Dome until you got it. So you got the record.
I think this is my first five-star. So it was
You know, and listen, we know in our hearts if it's a five-star or whatever, but I'm just saying it was critically acclaimed is the point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And I remember talking to Dave that night in the scrum, and it was pretty cool seeing him there, because me and Meltzer, like, early on, I don't know, it's like, you know, all the guys talk about, man, you don't need to be talking to Meltzer, you don't need to be doing this, or
right.
So you kind of just had this vision of Meltzer as being this evil character, right? But then I got to, like, talk to him and know him a little differently, and I thought differently of him, and he's been around a long time, and he's seen a lot of good stuff. Whether he's biased or not on certain things, that's fine. I don't care. It doesn't matter. But it was cool to receive a five-star from it.
Because it was a classic. That's why. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, how did you feel when Cody left AEW and went back to WWE?
Kind of down a little bit. It was, but, you know, Cody's... He's still young. There's such an age gap, 16 years. So now he's kind of in his prime now. But watching him return on WrestleMania was just huge. And, you know, I'm not going to miss any of his stuff. And he's on the rise to become a champion, you know. And I really think he's set the tone for that in his last 8 years of work and things that he's done. And he's built up. He's very professional. He's very different than I am. We're two completely opposite people. I mean, he has that creative mind like my dad had, you know, and I'm more the grunt, the worker in the family. Mm-hmm. But he is like surpassing everything. He's doing amazing.
That's great, man.
I wish he was still here.
Yeah, you know? I get a text from him actually quite frequently, and he always says, I miss you guys, man, I miss you guys. And I do miss having him around. You know, I do. I got much closer with him for obvious reasons in AEW than I ever was in WWE, but I still always had a connection with him in WWE as well.
Yeah,
you know? Always was the type of guy, like, I like that guy. So, all right, so that's another classic for you. What other ones stand out for you that you wanted to talk about?
2014, we had a nice story build. You know, Cody lost his job, and we're trying to win Cody's job back by facing the Shield, and we gave them their first loss, and the crowd was just nuts, man. And it was such a good match that we brought it back for the pay-per-view the next weekend and beat them for the titles. I mean, it's lightning. And we went on the road with them, Europe, all that stuff, having these barn burner 25-minute matches every night, me selling, giving Cody the tag, him coming, boom, boom, boom. And Seth has a really creative mind of putting these intricate finishes together, right? Just long, elaborated Japanese finishes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got like 15 minutes of finishes, right? But they all make sense, and you have moments in between all these things, and that's what makes them so great. And they were just some of the funnest matches I've ever had. I mean, the Shield, working with Roman, even Mox, but Seth is unreal.
Yeah, no, he is.
So much fun.
I liked working with all those guys when I was there, you know? Was that the one that Dusty was involved in as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was down there, and he was like, he took his belt off and was whipping Ambrose, you know, and it was magical. It was one of those magical nights. Another one was of course, Roddy Piper. That was
I love that match.
It was fun. It was
Let's talk in detail about that, because I think a lot of people forget as time goes on. It happens. Just like, obviously, Piper was a great talker. And what they forget sometimes is when he was hot and when he was on, he was a great worker too.
Yes.
Maybe not so much in the later years, but Roddy Piper in that match was the Roddy Piper that we all admired.
He was. So I don't find out, because I'm supposed to wrestle Razor Ramon, right, in a Miami street fight via satellite.
For WrestleMania.
Yes.
And this is when Goldust is super hot, but as a heel.
Yes.
Almost the kind of the transgender type of a cross-dresser.
Yes.
Type guy at times.
Yeah.
Very freaky.
I think they said androgynous.
Androgynous,
and Vince said that the first time when he presented that character to me, I was just agreeing with him. I had no idea what the hell that meant until we hung up the phone and I looked in the dictionary and I went, what did I just sign up for?
How did he pitch it?
Well, he's like, yeah, this androgynous character. And he mentioned Adrian Street, Adrian Adonis. So I remember them and how they presented their characters and things like that. I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool. So just this flamboyant person, right? That's what I thought androgynous meant, was flamboyant. And it's a little different than that.
Yeah.
But he presented that, you know, and I sunk my teeth into it. And it took me a good 6 months up there to try to figure out, because I didn't want to touch on the over the line kind of
homosexuality type thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I did not want to do that. And Savio talked me into it one night, and we were in the garden and I was so nervous because Vince was there. This was when he was at the curtain a lot watching the matches, right? He would just come on the road.
He used it as a barometer.
Yes.
Who was over, because his dad used to do that. So Vince was always watching. If you had a stinker in the garden or didn't get a reaction, you were screwed.
Yes.
And conversely, if you had a great match and got a great reaction, that would really help your case for all across the world.
It would, but I liked it when he was on the road and it wasn't a TV setting, right? Yeah. It was just a house show, and he would show up and it was like, he was at a curtain. I'm like, Vince is here. What if I do this? I'm going to get fired or whatever. And Savio was like, no, man, come on, let's do this. And it was just a simple go behind him, rub up his chest and down his legs, kind of not grazing his, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he turning around and he charging me and me taking a powder. And they went nuts and they called me every name in the book, and that's the first giant reaction that I've gotten. I was like, okay, that worked. I need to stay away from these rails because they are reaching hard at me, man. It was so before its time. And I was like, and I look at Savio back in the ring and he's laughing, and I'm like, god damn it, man. And I roll in there, I'm like, we lock up and he takes me back to the corner and said, we're going to do it again. Turn me around. And I'm like, what are we doing, man? Turn me around. And he said, turn around and stick your ass in my crotch and rub it back, you know, just kind of rub it around. And I did it and he pushed me away and I took another powder and they came again. And I was just like, it was set.
Yeah.
And it was easy. But I was really scared to do that. That was something that like was way out of my wheelhouse. I didn't, you know, that's kind of,
you're such a laid back guy. It's interesting to me that Vince saw that character in you. You know what I mean? Like that, like you said, that is a very flamboyant, over the top character, but he knew you could play that. It's interesting to me, knowing you as a person, where he would have seen that.
A lot of people say, hey, you know, they're like, is Vince ribbing Dad by putting the polka dots on him? You know, and I had that in the back of my head too. Is he ribbing me for this? But at that point, it was like, you know, I'd been trying to follow in my dad's footsteps for so long. And it was like, it's not working, man. I have to do something else. And we had a falling out, which was the worst decision of my life ever. And, you know, if you got one dad, right, one mom. So it's good to, like, work things out, right? But we were in that downtime where we weren't speaking to each other, and Vince had just called me and he presented that, and I said yes. And I remember my dad's reaction. He told me about it, and Cody was little and he's sitting there playing with his action figures and they're watching Raw, and here I come. And Cody tells a story that he looked back at Dad's face, and Dad's face was just like,
what?
He didn't know.
Yeah.
He didn't know. And now his son is dressed up like this, right? And is that running the road's name or the legacy? I don't look at it that way. I just look at it as me stepping into my own shoes and trying to do something on my own, and did it.
Yeah.
And it worked and got over, and, you know, it went through a lot of transitions and different character switch-ups and changes. And when he took away over the line stuff because it was pretty harsh towards the end of it, or like around 98 99. He started pulling it back a little bit, and I couldn't understand why. And but I was young still, right? I was just like 26 years old or whatever, and I was like, I couldn't understand why he was doing this. It's so over right now. Why are you doing this? So it's like, we need to do something else. So I had pitched the artist formerly known as Goldust and brought in Luna, and I suggested Luna because Luna fit that, man, and I knew Luna, and she was great. And it worked a little bit, but that just gave it a little more, you know, Goldust, a different side of Goldust. You know, this now he's just a freak. Mm-hmm. Now he's just this creepy freak, just will do anything, right? And everybody saw that I would do anything, and I would. I would do anything to continue getting this, try to get this character over, because I love wrestling. I want to make whatever I have work, because this is all I know, man. This is all I've ever wanted to do. And it's like, hey, man, let's find a way to make this work. And then it became, after that, that Goldust was no longer hated, that they just kind of fell in love with the character wherever I went. And you do a little bit of the mannerisms or whatever, and they remember that. And that's where it kind of went from there, right? And it's like, I didn't like wearing the wig anymore, you know, and stuff like that, and got rid of the wig and the robe stuff. And every once in a while I would wear it, but it just, I hated wearing it after that.
Well, so that's kind of the whole background of the character, which is great. And that leads us back to the Piper match we were talking about. You were, oh, no, it's good. I wanted to hear that. You were saying that it was originally going to be a Miami street fight with Razor Ramon.
Yes, and I know there was some office turmoil between him and whatever. And I know he didn't really like working with the Goldust character and things like that.
Interesting.
I don't know why.
Gotcha.
I really don't. But for whatever reasons, he left. So they, you know, we're there like 2 weeks before WrestleMania, or 3 weeks before WrestleMania, said, you're going to be on a plane tomorrow morning with Vince and Bruce Pritchard, you and Roddy Piper. And I'm like, okay, what are we doing, you know? We get to L.A. and we go eat at some famous restaurant, and we start discussing what we're doing. And this is the first time I'm hearing about it. And then we head over to Universal Studios, one of the back lots there. And they have this brand new white Bronco that was the same year and everything as the O.J. Simpson stuff, right? Yeah. And I'm looking and I'm like, okay, this is, and he explained this is a backlot brawl. So it's just a basic fight. And, you know, what he wanted at the end was me driving off, Roddy to move when I drove, right? And, you know, Roddy didn't decide to do that. So, and I had this spray painted old Cadillac and he got a brand new Bronco, which he asked Vince for, and he gave it to him. And right, I'm wondering where this gold Cadillac is. It's got to be in the vault up there somewhere.
Oh, he gave Roddy the Bronco?
Yeah.
And you had to return yours.
Yeah. So we get ready to do this, and they brought in all these extras, right? And they're cheering for me, which is really weird, but they're just extras. Mm-hmm. You know, these actors or whatever, the extra stuff. And they have these tables set up, and I'm supposed to drive in, and Vince let me get in the car and kind of spin out a little bit, trying to figure it out to come around the corner. It didn't work when we shot live. It just kind of stopped. And I started revving it up and started pulling forward. And he turns on this big giant fire hose sprinkler and he's spraying it, right? Like I can't see or whatever. Start driving forward. I stop and he picks up a baseball bat and he starts bashing the glass in. And it came on this side right here and he bashed it in. And we got cut up from it. So I crawled out the other side and he started kicking my ass. And I got one piece of offense in this, and that was a nut shot, just a low blow. And I wanted to get juice in this, and Vince didn't want it at all. So I asked Roddy to bust me open the hard way. And you'd think a veteran of his stature would know how to do that, right? So he gets me on top of the hood, and I said, okay, go, go, go. And he hits me square in the forehead so hard, right? And I'm feeling, and there's nothing else. Do it again. He hits me again, and he breaks his hand. He broke his hand on my head, and you can see it on the second shot to the forehead. And I had a bad concussion from that because he threw me in this big trash can. But he broke his hand. There was blood on us from the glass and all that, the baseball bat he would hit. But him being an actor, he knew how to swing it.
Right.
But you're in the heat of the moment, and this is a one-take thing. We can't reshoot this, right? So it's like, okay, we get to here now. You throw me into the trash can. Now I'm on the floor. You throw me at a table with all this catering food or whatever, and then there's my shot, right? And I there's my uppercut, and I get in the car, and he rolls kind of backwards by his Bronco, and I'm supposed to clip the Bronco and then drive off as he gets out of the way. It didn't work like that. So I revved up, and I'm watching Roddy, right? And I'm looking at the Bronco, and it's too close for me to do this and that. And I'm looking at his eyes, and I'm like, please move, please move. So I started going a little faster, and his eyes just got really bright, and I'm like, move, 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 and I keep going. And all of a sudden, he jumped up at the last second, his knees went boom, boom, and he landed on top of the hood, and he's holding me. He's looking at me in a deer in the headlights, and I'm looking at him, I'm like, get off the car. Get off the car. I thought I just ran over and killed Roddy Piper, right? Because I hurt his knees, and they hit hard.
Right. Was he trying to do that?
I think he wanted to do that. Yeah, right. Just because he's a stunt man in Hollywood, he's done that kind of stuff, right? So he finally rolls off, and I drive around the block, and we stop take. Right, he gets in the Bronco and chases me. Right, but in the meantime, when I hit him and I cut the corner, I knocked a dumpster. It started rolling to the head, the vice president of Universal Studios. Rolls Royce, and the cameraman is like holding the trash can while he's filming me, right? So he keeps the Rolls Royce from getting hit.
Right.
We drive off, and we come back, and all the extras are there, and I'm treating it like a shoot, and Roddy's up in the bathroom.
Right.
And I'm watching it back with Vince right there, and they're like, great job, and I'm cussing him, shut the fuck up, this shit ain't, you know, I'm being kayfabe like a $1 million, just man. Really... And it was so good. I went upstairs, and Vince and Bruce, they took us to the hospital. They're sitting in the hospital, and Vince is on a payphone while I'm waiting my time, and Roddy's getting his hand wrapped up and all that, and I go in, getting a lot of, you know, gimmicks and things, and it was like, I have a concussion. We get in the car. We go to the, right? We go get some beer.
Get some supplies. Go back
to the hotel. We fly out, and then... 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later is WrestleMania. They have our cars there parked in the parking lot covered up, right? So 2 days before WrestleMania, we have like rehearsals and stuff. And I go up to Vince and I say, hey, because we weren't wanting to put the Intercontinental title on him, but we weren't wanting to beat him either, you know? So it was like, how can we get out of this finish? So I suggested, hey, man, what if he pulls my suit off and I had lingerie underneath my suit, right? He's like, oh God, that's a good idea. So me and Terry, we went to the Fredericks of Hollywood on whatever
Melrose
Drive or whatever, and I said, let me try that on, right? And I put a couple things, okay, this works, and I had the garters and everything underneath, right? And it was like such weird stuff, but I was just, you know, really thinking outside the box, how can we make this better? And then they plugged it in, and we started the fight scene. The came of the WrestleMania day, they started the fight scene, then they went to a match. Then they came back, and they see the plugged-in O.J. Simpson chase scene, right? It wasn't actually Roddy. It was the O.J. scene, right? And then they go to another match, and they come back. Oh, my God, and the announcers are talking, are they coming to... the pond? Are they coming to Arrowhead Pond? It looks like they're heading this way, right?
Right.
And, you know, finally it gets time for us, and we're sitting in the back of the parking lot. I think Kasama was the one who gave us the cue to go.
Right.
I think she was there. And I'm supposed to drive through the barricade, right? And then Roddy's supposed to give me a count of five before he comes down. And the time I get down there and I open the door and get out, he slams into my door. So it didn't work like that, right? So I bust, he said, go, right? And the cameras are on us, and I bust through the barricade. He's right on me. And I'm looking in the rearview mirror, and I go down that little ramp at the pond, right? And I open the door, but he's so close to me, right? I open it, and it's slung back. And he just, whoosh, right into the side of the door. So I crawl out the other side, and I run inside, and it's when they had the tunnel entrance, right? And I'm right there, right at the tunnel, and Terry's there, Marlena's right there, and she's like, ah, and here he comes, screaming and yelling and finding me. So I start backing out of the tunnel, and as soon as I enter, man, they just went, right, just this huge boo, and I start backing up, and his music hit his bagpipes, and it was deafening, man. It was so cool. It was like, oh, and I'm just backing up doing the whole thing. And we get back there and we start our little fight, and he finally tears off all my stuff. It was just, oh my God, it's magic, right?
That was the finish, really, he tears off your clothes?
He tears off my clothes, and I roll out, and Terry covers me up, right? And his son comes in the ring, and it's kind of the end of the match.
Like a count out or like a non-finish, yeah. In Vince's mind, that's a finish, damn it.
And afterwards, I took my suit off, and I gave it to his son. And it was kind of ripped up and all that. And I talked to him years later. He still has it, he said. Colt.
That's cool, yeah, Colt, yeah.
So that's kind of neat. It was quite the experience. But I had to do the same kind of makeup because, you know, we had 3 weeks earlier, we had to take pictures of it to make sure in the blood, certain things, mm-hmm. I couldn't wash it, all that kind of stuff. But nobody knew I had that stuff underneath except Vince. And it was like such a shocking moment, and it really set the Goldust character off at that point, and it was on a run then, and it was nice. It was really cool.
It's interesting. I don't know if you know this, but the second Stadium Stampede was half taped, and then the finish was live. That was that concept was taken from your match with Roddy. Same idea.
Would the Roddy match be the first cinematic match?
I guess it could be, right? I can't think of anything prior. Maybe unless somebody might have done one in WCW or something, maybe back in those days, and they were doing a lot of crazy stuff.
That's pretty cool. So there's been some historical moments, you know, right?
And oh, yeah.
Well, there's another Stadium Stampede. I remember y'all doing that.
Yeah, like, we finished it live, which was, I think, Tony got the direct inspiration from your match with Roddy. Another one I want to talk about that I just thought about here, I was just looking up some of your matches online, is we just had our second Blood and Guts, and whenever we have the Blood and Guts, I always watch a couple of the other War Games. And another great one that you were involved in was Sting's
Squadron versus Dangerous Alliance, 92, I think, right?
Yeah.
Wrestle War Games.
Yeah, it was 92, that's right. Talk about that from what you recall, because that's going back like 30 years, like you said. That's a long time ago.
I think I started that one.
Yeah.
I think it was me and...
It was Ricky.
Arn?
It was Steamboat, Wyndham, Nikita, Dustin, and Austin. Sting versus Rude, Steve Austin, Arn Anderson, Bobby, and Larry. I think you might have started it with Steve. Or did you start it with Arn?
I think Steve.
Gotcha.
Because we both got some juice. It was a really good moment, man. Yeah. It was fun. It's probably one of the funnest matches I've ever been involved in. And to be in a few of those was really cool. And just using both rings, it was neat. But me and Austin, man. Like when he was really hungry in WCW and I was really hungry, not to sway off of this war game story, we would be on the road doing these 25-minute matches, just trying everything we could and really working hard, blowing ourselves up, slugging each other hard, you know, just real snug work. It was so much fun. And I remember one night we were in Phoenix and it was a fair show. Okay, so they had some of the fair audience come in. And Grizzly Smith was there as our agent, right? And we said, hey, can we go out and get some juice? You know, it's a fair show. But we were just hungry, having fun. So we did. We went out there, and I'll never forget it. And I love Lex Luger, right? But we came back, and Lex looked at us like we were just nuts. We're just two boys loving the business, trying to elevate. And you see where he went. You see where Austin went, you know? And I've had a great career.
That's right, yeah.
And I've done some amazing things, but it was just us wanting to bring and get the most magic and, you know, touch the audience. I think that's what we do as performers, is try to make them feel something. And we did, and we always did, and it was really good. And it's like, and this leads to War Games, right? And Austin's in there. Here we are, man. Two guys that just want to make this thing better. And you're fighting for 5 minutes before anybody gets in there, and then everybody starts rolling in. It's such a crazy match, but it was really structured nicely with the, you know, everybody comes in every 3 minutes or whatever it was, 5 minutes. So there was always the flip of the coin, you know. We always lost the odds, so it was like, I think was Medusa in that one when she was on top of the cage, and Paul Heyman was there.
Yeah, each had a manager
throwing the phone in and all that kind of stuff. So good, so visually cool, man. But I liked the cage when it was like that, because you could do a front atomic, and their head would hit the middle.
It was fairly low.
I did that with Arn a couple times. It was so cool, and it's visually really neat. It's like, oh shit, he hit his head.
Yeah,
and it's like you couldn't, like, if you're on the top rope, you couldn't like really jump out. You'd have to duck to do a clothesline because it was pretty low, right? ours here was a lot higher.
Oh, it was very high. Yeah.
So it's like, but it was cool that we could use the top. You could hang on mm-hmm. it and kick somebody or drop kick somebody or whatever. So I loved those cages.
Was Dusty booking at that time frame in 92?
Yes.
How was it for you being the book, the proverbial booker's son?
You know, back then my dad, you know, as a lot of dads probably do, they, you know, in this situation, you know, he's always, hey, that could have been better or whatever, right? You know, the later years, he was so proud of me and he said so a lot. But back then, when I'm trying to find my own way,
it's hard on you.
And he didn't push me to the world title, you know, like, say, Eric Watts.
Right.
Or they tried to really push him, and they didn't bite for that. So he made me work hard for it, which I'm really glad. And, yeah, I got the United States titles and the world tag team titles and all that. But I didn't get any farther than that. I was on my way for that, and then I got let go. But I think he did it the right way, and he made me kind of – he took me to Florida for, like, a year before that. I was making $20 a night, so I paid my dues. But I was working every night and learning in front of audiences and even small audiences, working every night, though, instead of just in a right. training school.
Which is what you need.
In the reps. Snake pit with, you know, Mike Graham and Steve Kern sweating it out, which we did that at the beginning. Mm. But that's where you learn is on the road, where you learn is in front of people. And by trial and error, you're trying these things. But for me, for the first 3-4 years, I didn't say a word. Back then, you had 95% of the people could work, right? And everybody else that was green coming in, you just shut up and listen. That was the rules. You shut up, you do what you're told, you listen, and I did that. And you're working with Barry and Arns and Ricky Steamboats and Bobby Eaton's, man, they led you to greatness. Mm-hmm. They made you look good. They yeah. knew what their job was. Whether they did it because it was Dusty's son, I don't know, but they made me, and they learned me how to work. And, you know, those are my teachers. Mm-hmm. Those are my real teachers in the business. So if I ever make it to the Hall of Fame one day, they're definitely going to be called out as being my teachers. And I'm just glad, like, Steamboats are still around and Arn's still here with us. And, you know, as much as the business changed, you know, a lot of the old timers maybe get a little jaded or whatever about the business and like, oh God, you know, this and that. But I think they also understand that there's growth and it's not 1985 yeah. anymore. Oh, yeah, yeah. And
the smart ones do.
Yes.
The smart ones do.
And they grow with it. You either grow or you get the f-
We did.
Right.
Look, we're those guys now. That's
yeah.
true though.
Yeah.
You mentioned Steamboat a few times. There's a great one of you and Steamboat because you teamed quite a bit versus Arn and Zbyszko. I don't know if you remember that specific match, but
that was a good one. Well, that's the first time we did the car angle, the same thing we did with Jake when he broke my arm in the car door. It was the same
setup.
We were
just in that city. Where was it? Charleston, West Virginia.
Yeah.
We were just there.
Charleston.
That, yeah.
And it was, you put a little piece of board, we pull up in my dad's Mercedes, like Barry was driving it, right? And we get out and we start the fight right there, and they slam the door. I think this was the week before or whatever. They slammed the door in Barry's arm. So now I had to find a partner. I had this mysterious partner. He came out in the big dragon suit, Savannah, Georgia. I remember it. And it was in one of those crowds that was loud. When we won the titles that night, it was mm-hmm. it was so loud. And people remember those, right?
Yeah.
And it was... I'm just listening to Larry and Arn. Larry was more the, you know, you really had to really kick him in gear for him to want to go and do anything, yeah, right? Yeah. But he was so good when he did. When he was working, man, and that night was like perfect. And Ricky got that comeback, that hot comeback. Such a reaction when I took the thing off his head, and it's Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, right? If you didn't already know that, right, yeah, the dragon head, right? But it was so cool. And we won the titles that night, and it was just like, wow, this is it's one of those moments, you know, that stand out. I mean, I've had a lot of them, but not like those, you know, like the ones we've mentioned today that really just stand the test of time. And I think Cody and mine's match will go down for at least a decade as being one of the – I really do That's believe classic. That is one of those that – they remember
one of the matches of the year that year. There's another, as we wind down here, there's one more I want to talk about, which is probably your other greatest AEW match, which was you and QT versus the Butcher and the Blade.
Oh, jeez.
Remember that one? You forgot about that one, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, bunkhouse match.
Bunkhouse match. Remember yeah. how good that was?
It was good.
I had forgotten about that until right now. I just looked up the best match of Dustin Rhodes as we've been talking, and I saw this. Like, I forgot that how good that match was.
It was a lot of fun. I mean, we had some gimmicks in there, and we had QT, man, came off a 12-foot ladder, and it's like his hip was hurting for a month after that. Yeah. I mean, Shawn Michaels would do it like nothing, right? But mm-hmm. QT came off. I remember getting handcuffed. This wasn't supposed to happen, right? Because Lee was supposed to come out and help me with the key. And I was handcuffed to the corner, and Blake came over and hit me, and it knocked my balance off. I was on the apron, and it ripped the handcuff off.
Oof.
And it squeezed my arm so tight. So this one piece is on my arm the whole match, right? And then we go over, and we do a big stunt with me and Butcher into this bed of nice soft landing stuff, right? But, you know, it was like, we should have made it a little bit deeper.
Yeah.
But whatever. And we can make it back to the ring with this, all this stuff going on outside. Bunkhouse, I love bunkhouse matches or bull rope matches. They're fun. Bunkhouse are more fun.
Just a big street fight with
gimmicks,
farm stuff.
And, yeah, and they put a lot of the, you know, those kind of props out, and it was kind of cool. And then, you know, we had the finish, and it was a nice little match.
Was that still when we were working in front of no people? Or did we have people there at that point?
We had people there.
Yeah,
we had people. Yes, we had a lot of people at that one. It was one of the sellouts, I think, we had.
How was it for you working in front of no people?
It's tough.
For guys like us, you know?
You need the energy,
yeah.
Right? You need somebody to scream and yell boo or yay or whatever. And when there's not, and it's just, I mean, our little roster member that was around there and the extras, mm-hmm. enhancement talent and stuff would do it. It helped because they knew when to cheer, when to boo and things like that. But, man, it's nothing like 20,000 people screaming at you, right? Mm-hmm. You just feel that energy, and it makes everything a lot easier, and it's a lot harder, and it's cold when you're taking these bumps and there's no reactions and things like, but we did it.
Yeah, we had to.
I mean, we did some unprecedented things, and we were there 35 degrees, 32 degrees at nighttime in Florida. It never gets that cold in Florida, really.
110 at other points.
It's free. You're blowing out smoke, and they got heaters under the ring, and they didn't work.
Yeah,
I remember Uno slapping me in the face so hard it felt like needles.
Yeah, it's like catching.
I rolled out of the ring, man. I'm just like, ow, what the hell?
Last couple questions for you. Who helped you the most when you were starting out? Is there an old timer vet or someone maybe that's underrated that gave you, like, for me, it was a guy called Jerry Morrow, who was a legend in Calgary that no one really ever heard of outside maybe Japan. Was there somebody like that for you?
There was. Harley was there.
Wow.
Mike Graham and Steve Curran really, like, learned me the ropes, right?
Florida.
And was really like a father figure when, because dad wasn't there. Right. He was off doing his stuff, right? I went down there. And then I come up to NWA. Still with Kendall, and there really wasn't anybody because that didn't last that long, but everybody took to me fine. But it wasn't really till about WCW when Arn and Bobby Eaton and Barry Windham, because me and Barry had known each other since kids, and me just being around them and driving around them and learning their ways and the way they handled business and things like that, and just listening to Arn because we worked a lot. And they, like I said, they were my teachers. And I learned the most probably from Arn and Steamboat. Mm-hmm. Like some nights I would want to sell and Steamboat said, no, I want you to sit and watch this. And I got the best seat in the house. Yeah. So I learned his selling and the way he used his hands. Even if his face was covered up, he's using his hands to sell and shake. And you feel it. And you know, he's the greatest salesman in the business.
Yep.
The greatest arm drag in the business. Yeah. So you learn those two things, you're going to be really good, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why I started really liking to sell, because I really think you can tell a good story by selling. So many guys don't want to sell anymore. It's like, let's just do this and get up and do this and please let me sell. Even if you're going over, I still like to sell, right? But I'm going to get my stuff in, but it's like, I'm going to sell, man. I have to. I think that is kind of what's missing today.
The art of selling.
The art of selling, right? So they were, you know, Arn, Steamboat, learned a lot from Sting, driving around with him, just learning. If I could have hung around with Sting a lot more, I would probably be better off at business because he was very smart in that aspect. But I hung around Barry, you know?
And
we went out and we partied and we drank and we, you know, went to work the next day and we had great matches and all that. And it was... that was my life, you know, the party life, but having fun. And right. I just wish, you know, looking back on it now, I have no regrets, none, because those are my teachers. And all the mistakes I made, they taught me valuable lessons. And but looking back at it, you know, I wish I would have done some things differently, right? And maybe I would be a little more better off than I am now, but I'm really happy with where I'm at now. I've got my life together, so that's all that matters to me. It's family, taking care of my family, and, you know, that's it.
Last question for you. I never have an answer to this when people ask me, but I'm going to ask you, how much longer do you want to go? How much longer do you feel like you can go? Have you even thought about it?
I have. That's a tough question, man. It's in my blood, you know? So it's like, and I look at Ric Flair in his supposed last match, and I don't want to do that, right? So as long as I can get out of the business and still walk, and even if I have, because I do need a couple of knee replacements, but that's fine. I'll get knee replacements. I'll be fine. I'll be able to walk around. But I just remember getting in the business and seeing a couple of the old timers on walkers, you know, and in wheelchairs. And I'm like, I don't want to get to that point.
Right.
But we throw our bodies around and eventually something's going to happen. So if I can get out of the business where I can still kind of semi enjoy walking at least and, you know, enjoy the rest of my life, that's fine. But I love the business. So I want to be connected to it in some way, whether it's just backstage coaching or whatever, because I really love coaching. It's a lot of fun for me. A lot of people don't like it. I love it. I love putting together stuff for these kids to try to figure out. And my vision is always different than their vision. And I see them do it, and it's like not my vision, and it makes me mad, but it's what they see my vision as being. So I understand it, and I'm patient with that. And I love to tell them, hey, man, you did this, you did this, do this next time. And then they go out and do it, and it works for them, right? So that's kind of the knowledge that I want to pass on. So that's my legacy now, is passing on my knowledge to the younger kids.
You're one of the all-time greats, man.
You are too. Well, we're the last of our kind.
We are, and it's great talking to you. Thanks, Dustin.
You too, buddy.